I'm Evan Foreman, and this is Necessary and Sufficient.
So, this is the 100th episode of Necessary and Sufficient. Jesse Thorne is on today, which is really kind of a dream come true in a way. I was listening just now to the audio that I recorded with Roman Mars for the 12th episode of Necessary and Sufficient about 2 years ago. And sort of in the run-up to, you know, having our actual conversation playing the Necessary and Sufficient game, we were talking about sort of, you know, modeling ourselves after radio personalities. And I sort of talked about how, you know, Jesse's voice is one of the ones that I hear in my head when I am on the mic here. And, you know, Roman told me, oh, yeah, I'm about to have dinner with him, or I had dinner with him last night or something like that. And it just, I don't know, it was great sort of to hear that somebody like this is only two hops away from me. And it was even greater to have him on. So this is a real thrill. The episode's a little longer than usual, and I hope that's okay, but I think there's some good stuff in here. I want to thank everybody who's listening for listening. I want to thank all the guests who have been on for guesting. I want to thank Hallie for helping me find the time to put this together every week. It's really been an amazing experience, and I'm so happy to be doing it. And I've got lots more stuff planned, so, you know, going to keep on. Those of you out there who would like to get involved somehow, there's a bunch of ways to do that. One is to go to the iTunes store and assign the podcast a star rating, or even better, write a review. It only takes a minute, and it's a huge help. Other things to do are to follow Duck and Ched on Twitter, like Necessary and Sufficient on Facebook, go to the website and send me an email there, evan@duckandched.net. You can kick in a few bucks. I'm looking to make some equipment upgrades in the coming weeks, so a few bucks towards that would be much appreciated. And drop me a line, tell me what you think, and, you know, go and comment on an episode. Let's just keep going. Do you have any questions?
No, I'm ready to go.
About the rules? The rules are there are no rules.
Cool.
So if you're ready, you can go ahead and open that envelope.
I have fashion and style.
So these are two words that are, like, at times used synonymously, but at times not. Like, in fact, I think that there are some magazines that call themselves fashion and style magazines.
Sure, like Fashion and Style Magazine, for example.
That would be a great example of that.
FNS.
So what's the difference between, or what's the sameness between fashion and style, do you think?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I usually identify Put This On, which is my menswear blog, as a style blog rather than a fashion blog.
And that's a conscious choice that you've made.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I try and do it as unpretentiously as possible. But I think what it means is that fashion is primarily about essentially about a social relationship. And style is partly about a social relationship, but also significantly about an aesthetic relationship. And style is broader than fashion. And style also is, I would say, more masculine than fashion. And it aspires to a relative timelessness, whereas fashion aspires to continuously be in the now, or perhaps a moment ahead.
So style is sort of more like about rules that go on through time, you think, or guidelines?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's rules that go on through time in the same way that, you know, the golden mean is a rule that goes on through time. You know, I mean, that is obviously moderated by the fact that we do live in a complex social relationship with a lot of other people, and I'm not, you know, Issey Miyake. I'm not trying to deconstruct fashion and create something that exists outside of fashion based on pure aesthetic rules or standards that have not been applied to things in the past. You know, I'm comfortable with the sort of classic Western tradition as a template to work from. So rules, I mean, I think men, especially when they're learning to dress, are really keen on rules. And I can understand why. You know, I think a lot of men are, and, you know, I'm speaking broadly here, but I think a lot of men are problem-solving oriented, and they like to work with sort of concrete systems. And, you know, that can get to be a bit much sometimes. You know, people ask me, what's the rule on this? What's the rule on that? What's the rule on this? What's the rule on that? And at some point, you just have to make a choice for yourself based on your own values. But, you know, I try and be respectful of the way that your choices affect both you and other people. And often that's based on a sort of social contract that may include rules and guidelines.
So I want to go back to something you said a little while ago, which is, you know, you're making a distinction and you said that fashion is about social relationships. So do you feel like, I mean, when you say that, do you mean a relationship between two people or between a person and the culture that they're living in? Or, you know, is that relationship hierarchic in any way?
Well, I don't know. I mean, have you ever read like a Jane Austen novel?
I've seen some movies about that.
Yeah, so I mean, they're always talking about what kind of hat they're wearing in Paris, right?
Right.
And that is the definition of fashion. It's a way, essentially, of organizing social relationships, which I understand and is fine with me. I mean, I don't hate it or anything, but it's sort of exhausting to me. And it's not, definitely not what I want to dedicate my life to. So I'm open to it. I mean, and I understand that it's significant. I mean, you don't see me wearing, you know, willfully archaic clothes, or, you know, you don't see me in some kind of crazy uniform like a, you know, I have a family friend who always wears a work jumpsuit.
It's easy because you just get up and it's like one clothes.
Yeah. And I mean, he's actually a really, you know, he's like a cool gay Filipino guy, you know, like, he's a hairdresser who studied with Vidal Sassoon. So, you know, like, he's a cool dude, but that's something that I would exhaust me. Yeah. So, I mean, I try and be as moderate and modest as I can, just because I see the fashion media outside of me, and it's really set up to sort of condition people to buy things. And the journalistic values that I see aren't always great. And that just kind of skeeves me out.
Right.
And I just don't want to be that person, you know?
I mean, I think you hit on something really interesting with the guy that you're talking about that wears the jumpsuit. And I think, you know, because you took the time to tell me that he's a gay Filipino dude who studied with Vidal Sassoon, you sort of told me about his credentials. And I think what you were doing on some level was like providing context. You know, you're saying he's making a choice that doesn't seem cool, but it is cool because of who he is, you know? And I think there's really something there about knowing the rules. I mean, I actually wrote down some quotes from the Put This On videos. There was an episode on tradition, and one of the guests was talking about, you know, first learning the rules and understanding them and then breaking them afterwards. And I think that there's a way that certain people dress when they're explicitly flaunting rules, where it only really works if you know that they know the rules to begin with, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a sort of classic saying that gets, you know, repeated around until it's meaningless. But I think that there's something to be said for that, especially in the sense that there's really no power to breaking the rules if you don't know what they are.
Right.
You know, then you're just being a dip.
I mean, I guess I'm sort of elaborating on it and adding another layer, I think, maybe not, maybe it's already there, which is that not only do you have to know the rules before you break them, but like there's also a way in which a lot of times people wink at the rules because they don't want somebody to think that they didn't know them at all. Like a key part of that transgression is denoting that the transgression is being made consciously.
Yeah, well, I mean, the tricky bit of it is that you can say these things even about, you know, there's a generational distinction here, which is, you know, we live in a type of culture that I don't think has ever existed before, at least the way it does now, in that, you know, in a Jane Austen book, certain rich people have access to, you know, a note that someone carried in by a horse that says what kind of hat they're wearing in Paris, right?
Right, right.
And now everyone is connected to everything. And we've already been through, you know, retro and, you know, futuristic and everything. And, you know, in the 1960s, people used their clothes to identify themselves as anti-establishment and rebellious. And, you know, the whole idea of being anti-establishment and rebellious as a sort of generational cultural thing is relatively new. And, you know, like maybe the Jazz Age or something is when it started. And, you know, it really only became what it is today and with teenagers in the 50s, you know. So, but those people are now in control. You know, Bill Clinton is not just the president. He's now an elder statesman. You know what I mean? I think he's sort of the classic member of that generation.
Right.
And, you know, my parents are of that generation to some extent. You know, my parents were both born in the early 40s. No, my dad was a peace activist for most of his life in the vets movement. And, you know, my mom was super bohemian and, you know, neither of them were really hippies. I mean, maybe more bohemian than hippie, but, you know, they lived anti-establishmentness. My dad was on an organization he co-founded was on the list of domestic enemies to the state.
Wow.
You know? And
that's hardcore. That's cred.
Yeah, you know, like he got used to, and this is a pacifist organization, let me be clear.
Right.
Like this isn't, they weren't domestic terrorists.
I guess it depends on who you ask.
Yeah, well, and you know what your standards for terrorism are, but they weren't trying to overthrow the government through violent means. You know, and so those statements have been made. And at this point, in my mind, the kind of the idea of breaking the rules for the sake of breaking the rules to demonstrate that you're a revolutionary, there's no juice left in that. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no punch left in that. I mean, that at this point is, you know, I mean, it's 60-year-old guys in Tommy Bahama shirts or 60-year-old guys on Harley Davidsons. Like, these are the least cool things I can think of, you know?
Right. Right.
And so there, in some ways, it circled back to, at least in my mind and for me, a matter of making an informed choice about, you know, how you want to present yourself to the world and whether you want to present yourself to the world as, you know, whatever it is, making it whatever, however it is that you want to present yourself to the world, making it an informed choice.
Right. And that choice can be what seems on first blush like the most vanilla thing. I mean, it can be like a really solid baseline. It doesn't have to be something that's off in the, you know, really far away from the point of origin.
Yeah. And I mean, the other side of that is that, you know, I think that a lot of men particularly are uncomfortable with embracing aesthetic values. You know, I mean, men are just uncomfortable with the idea of beauty and, you know, because they think it's feminine or gay or whatever. And I think that that is something that's, you know, it's a really important thing that enriches us all and it shouldn't be ignored. And so maybe it's possible to make the thing that sets you apart that you actually care about aesthetics and beauty and making things nicer to see, not just for you, but also for people that you interact with. I mean, there's dandyism, you know, which is about a kind of look at me caricature of aesthetics, which can be fun. I mean, you know, I'm not beefing with that, but there's also something that says, I'm going to do the normal thing, but I'm going to do it in, you know, the sort of respectful societal norm thing. But the difference that I'm going to make is that it's going to be particularly nice. You know, that makes everyone else's life around you better. And I think it's a sort of a more modest choice rather than a more sort of presumptive and self-centered choice.
So if fashion is sort of transitory and season by season, and, you know, like you said, the hats in Paris, and style is kind of perennial in a way, in that, you know, it's like the quality of a cut of something, or there's, you know, stitching or lapels, etc. I mean, these two things, though, they're interlocked. Like, they're not, you know, they're not totally separate.
That's true.
You know, there are all these stories about how, like, oh, the king was so fat that he couldn't button his vest, and now we don't button the bottom buttons of our vests. And there are all these little anecdotes like that. And I'm assuming that most of them are apocryphal, but some of them are not, probably. And even the ones that are speak to this idea that year-to-year fashion or minute-to-minute fashion gets coded somehow in perennial style. And I think that, like, the opposite sort of happens too. I don't know if this is exactly the opposite. Maybe opposite is not the right word. But if you have a perennial style, eventually the fashion is going to cycle back around and catch up with you again.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're talking about a couple of different things there, it feels like to me.
Yeah, I do that. Yeah.
I mean, there's, you know, there's this issue of the king wore this or the Duke of Edinburgh wore that. You know, that's success and power are less tied in with class. And I mean that in the sort of broad sort of breeding sense, you know, than they ever were before, which I think is probably good. You know, I think that our aesthetic movers and shakers are more democratically chosen now. You know, I think that Kanye West influences people's aesthetic choices because, you know, he's great at music. And he's very well dressed,
right?
You know, could be a lot worse. You know, so there's that. I think that we certainly look to people who are more powerful than us. I mean, it speaks to, you know, people. You know, the monkeys looking at the magazine covers and choosing the people that are on more magazine covers to copulate with. You know,
but is that a thing?
Yes, it's I mix my metaphors there a little bit, but yes, there have been ape studies involving essentially making some apes famous and other apes not famous.
Wow.
That demonstrate that even if you haven't met them, there is an appeal to famousness, well-knownness, respectedness through that. And, you know, that's just in our, you know, the thing that makes human beings special is how social we are, and so that's just coded into our brains. It's just a weird thing that happens, and I'm not going to fight it. But, so that's thing number one. I don't remember what the rest of the things were.
There were a few of them. I mean, you know, I think what you're talking about is authority also. And I think about this, you know, in the art world too. It's like, you know, you can make sort of anti-establishment choices or controversial choices or choices that are outside the realm of sort of what's expected of you. But those are only accepted as valid if you've made sort of previous choices that are close enough to the mainstream that you've established some kind of authority, right? And it's such a complicated thing. It's like, you know, when you, and I think this, you know, this has to do with style and art and all kinds of different communicative media, I guess, where it's like, you know, you get anointed in a way through performance, and then you have the, you know, to use your word from before, the juice to anoint new things that might be a little bit more challenging.
I think that also, if you want to create a contrast, you have to create a baseline. And, you know, I mean, I think of one of the best things that I learned in acting school was from a guy who had been a clown in the Pickle Family Circus, which is sort of famous alternative circus. And, you know, the thing that he said that I thought was really cool was, you know, it's only funny to drop all the balls while you're juggling if you just did an amazing juggling thing.
Right.
He said it more elegantly than I did, but, you know, you...
No, I think thing is the unit of juggling.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, yeah. If you do something amazing and then have a disaster, that's funny. But if you just have a disaster, that's not that funny. And the reason that is because you have to have something to contrast against, you know, just like you have to have a really rich, cool guy falling over is funny and a poor old lady falling over is less funny. And that's the case for the breaking of the rules as well. You know, what you have to demonstrate in order for your breaking of the rules to have meaning, you have to demonstrate that you get what the rules are so that you know that, so that you're then demonstrating that you are breaking the rules. It's the same reason that people like abstract artists who are also highly skilled in creating more literal art.
That's a good example. I've actually talked about that on this podcast before, about how that stopped happening in the 60s. That, you know, if you look at like Jackson Pollock's early work, very figurative, like there's all these self-portraits and stuff, and it's almost like this is where that authority comes from to break those rules. But as time went on, people stopped necessarily being able to do that. You know, as a culture, as we sort of accepted the idea of abstract art as more valid. You know, and that sort of reminds me of this thing about, you know, your friend with the jumpsuit. It's like an abstract artist, when abstract art was a new and controversial thing, you know, there was sort of this asterisk about like, well, he could do something better if he wanted to, you know?
But, you know, even I have a friend who's a professional artist, and I went to see his thing in the Los Angeles Biennial. And when we went out to see this thing, like he's mostly a sculpture artist, and his sculptures are, it's not him carving a piece of marble until it looks beautiful, you know?
Right.
And so like he had a piece that was a tree made out of the magnetic tape from VHS tapes. So, you know, it had a trunk and branches that were, you know, made of metal tubes that had been bent. And then the leaves and stuff, it was like a weeping willow, you know? And he had a hay bale that had been coated in a sort of like gold colored metal. He said that he wanted to use gold, but they didn't think they could do it. And he had, you know, there's a variety of different things. You know, he had these thrift store paintings that he'd created a floor from for his area of this exhibition. And he had this body that he had bought in a thrift store a head, and had created a body for this head by having an acquaintance of his essentially cast in some sort of crazy resin and sized to fit this thrift store clay head. And, you know, it was like life-sized. And the thing about all these things is like none of these things is the sort of traditional paint a pretty picture, Michelangelo's David, you know, study of the human form type thing. But one thing that they do all have in common is that they do all involve a process that lets you know, like, hey, we're serious about this.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? And it's sort of like that, hey, we're serious about this, is what makes for impact in the fact that it is unusual at the end. You know, like the fact that someone worked for it is meaningful, even if that work for it meant that they like went to a resin casting firm and talked with them until they were willing to make a laser copy of a, you know, some art teacher's body.
Right. Well, there's craft involved, and there's what's the word? Materials that are, you know, like oil paint and marble have certain kind of oomph to them, you know, because they're kind of expensive and hard to work. And I think that a lot of these materials also have the same kind of oomph, like cast resin and you know, gold hay stuff. Like they have specialness, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that what all of that is about is it's just the symbolism of, hey, I tried, you know, and in a way, that's a really central part of dressing well, is just the part where you're saying to the outside world, I care enough about this interaction with you that I put on a tie, you know,
or
did whatever, you know, whether it's put on a tie or just like matched my colors well. When you can see that it was a choice to do something.
Right.
Even frankly, if it's this kind of Los Angeles thing, which is like, I care so much about this interaction that I put on incredibly expensive sweatpants, you know, all of those things, part of it is about just demonstrating to other people, you know, partly, oh, I have the means to do this, but and the skills to do this, but partly just I give a crap.
Right.
I'm not sure if I'm allowed to swear, so I said crap.
Oh no, you can say whatever. Do you want to change that?
I can partly. Partly, I just I give a shit.
That's great. We can use. Oh, I now have options. I mean, I was thinking when you were saying that stuff about, you know, giving a whatever, and hey, I tried. I was thinking about this interaction that I had with. I used to work in advertising, and I was in the lobby of the building where I worked, and one of the art directors walked by, and he was this like, you know, pretty attractive gay guy, you know, and sort of tangentially. I know. See, I have an anecdote about a gay person also. And I think he was sort of, he did fashion stuff. Like this is a kind of like a very traditional ad agency, but he also did fashion stuff sort of on his, in his off hours, some magazines and things. And I stopped him in the hallway and I was in the lobby and I was like, dude, you're wearing like a Mickey Mouse t-shirt and like literally like a Mickey Mouse t-shirt and a pair of jeans. And he was like pulling it off. Great. You know? And I wear t-shirts and I wear jeans all the time. And yet I feel like kind of a schlub when I do that, because that's just, you know, that's my thing, I guess. But there's something about his aura that like wearing the Mickey Mouse shirt and the jeans had the, hey, I tried built into it.
I mean, that's about your context with him, which involves both his, you know, his place in the world and your knowledge of the fact that he dresses this way. And, there's also a lot of social coding that goes into it. I mean, if you take the example of selvedge denim, you know, this is this kind of blue jeans that has now almost has close to them to being mainstream, I would say, but it has its roots in Japan 15 years ago or so, something like that. And basically what it is at some point, over the course of the sort of middle of the 20th century, American denim manufacturers went from weaving their denim on narrow looms, which is sort of the traditional way of weaving. You are limited by the width of the loom, and the loom could only be so wide, to weaving the denim on these huge wide looms. And I don't specifically understand the difference between these two machines technologically, but basically, in the 60s and 70s, they figured out how to, you know, weave a piece of fabric that's 100 feet wide instead of 4 feet wide or 6 feet wide or however wide they are. And so essentially, when they used to make blue jeans, they would leave the selvedge in, and you would see it in the seam. And the selvedge is the edge of the fabric where there's... Traditionally, in denim, it would usually be like white with a red line. And that's where the fabric is finished. It's, you know, just like the edge of a knit scarf is finished.
Right, to keep it from unraveling.
Yeah, exactly. And it's because it hasn't been cut. It's, you know, looped back the other direction, you know. So that was the traditional. They would use this whole piece of fabric, and one of the sides would be the actual edge of the fabric. Now, when you make a super, super wide piece of denim, you know, that's 100 feet wide or however wide your factory is, you just cut it, right? And you finish the edges so that they don't unravel by sewing them. You know, you sew them and you give it a special stitch so that it doesn't unravel. So basically, the huge wide fabric, for obvious reasons, is a lot more efficient to produce. And so denim makers just switched to that, right? Meanwhile, all these old machines ended up in Japan being collected first by just people that needed industrial equipment, but then after that by people who were sort of fetishizing this old industrial equipment. Hmm. And the functional difference between selvedge denim, you know, the jeans that have that finished edge, and regular denim, you know, the 501s you would buy in Sears, is, all other things being equal, tiny.
Non-existent.
Yeah, I mean, when was the last time that the problem with your jeans was the edge of the inside seam was coming apart? You know what I mean?
It's been a while.
So these Japanese guys that were into the way that jeans were made in the 50s and 60s started cuffing their jeans so that you can see that little stripe. Mm. You can see the little stripe that represents the edge of the fabric so that you can tell that that pant was woven on a narrow loom instead of a wide loom.
It's and, so coded.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously that's something that like nobody would know, especially 10 or 15 years ago, that nobody would know except for people that were obsessed with that.
Right.
You know?
And even those would have to be within 5 or 6 feet.
Yeah, exactly. So why is that significant? Well, like in their social world, that's a really powerful indicator. And, you know, it's also representative of other values that this garment has been made with. So,
right.
You know, I mean, obviously as production has become, has been on a larger and larger scale, you know, they find ways to cut costs, and today's jeans overall are made less well than jeans were made in the 50s.
Right.
Because price is the most important bending point. And so essentially that little stripe becomes a symbol of I care enough to have the good jeans, and or I can, I mean, to some extent also I can afford the good jeans, but it's a symbol that's only meaningful to the guys that know it, right?
Right.
These people are all guys, by the way. The guys' versions of this tend to have a complicated technical explanation attached to them rather than the women's ones, which often don't, but they're basically the same thing.
Right.
It's just guys like to read about machines.
Well, and it's also there's also a black or white thing about that. I mean, there's an objectivized, do you have the red thread or do you not? And I think that's very male in a way also.
Yeah, absolutely. Men like clarity, and essentially it just becomes a synecdoche. I think that's a synecdoche where one thing stands in for a larger set of things.
It could be a metonymy.
Yeah. And so that little tiny thing is code for a big set of other things about knowing what's what. And that knowing what's what is the part that's the social currency.
Right. So it's a stand-in for the better genes, which are themselves a stand-in for a sort of a better way of life.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that's also obviously tied in with other social relationships like class and so on and so forth. But that's the thing is that when all those things are put together, you know, even if you don't literally know the part about the stripe on the side of the selvage stripe, you know, you might be able to pick up in some total the general sense that someone is better dressed than you.
Right, right. And that they're doing something on purpose.
Yeah, exactly. I have a lot of respect for people that, you know, express their own cultural values through the way that they dress and their personal values as well, even when those are ridiculous. You know, like there's a really great chapter in John Waters' most recent book about why he wears specific high fashion clothing. I'm trying to remember who his...
Oh, it's Comme des Garçons, right?
Yeah. And
yeah, it's a great chapter.
Yeah, it's really cool. And what I like about it is, you know, you couldn't find a more countercultural figure than John Waters, obviously. You know, like John Waters is so countercultural that... but like what's so cool about it is that you know that he's making this choice, you know, and he's making it based on specific reasons because he wants the world to be a certain way. In John Waters' case, I think he wants to improve the world, you know, and I think that's pretty neat.
Well, the way he describes all those garments is pretty interesting because almost every single one of them, he talks about how they have a conceptual bent.
Yeah.
Sort of the overtone is, oh, all the stuff is so hideous, but I wear it anyway because I love it. But then every single one of them, he talks about how the buttons are on the wrong side, or it's almost unwearable because of this, or it looks like it's been stained, but it hasn't. You know, like he takes great pains, it seems like, from what I remember, to enumerate the specific transgressions.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that the best high fashion does one of either two things. I mean, if you're a couturier, my French isn't very good, which is to say I do not speak French at all. I would basically just say Jacques Cousteau a bunch of times.
that was good, though. That was really good. That
thank
one.
You. Yeah. So if you're a couturier or a couturier, your job is to make a lady look as beautiful as possible. It's sort of like being a tailor. You know, a tailor is a craftsperson more than He is a designer. And a couturier is in many ways a craftsperson whose skill is both, you know, often the sort of stitching or the embroidery or whatever, the manual skills, but also making a woman look beautiful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that plays on these things that are inside of our brains that we can't control, you know, like we like big boobs or whatever. And, you know, maybe to some extent sort of long-term cultural values, like maybe, you know, in times of plenty, we like women that are skinny and in, you know, whatever. But basically you're trying to make a lady look beautiful. So that's one thing. The other cool high fashion thing, I think, is that kind of abstract and conceptual work, which, as John Waters points out quite accurately, you know, designers like Yohji Yamamoto and stuff like that, you know, especially these Asian designers, because they had a little bit of an outsider's perspective on fashion culture, which was very Eurocentric and America-centric, they were able to do something that was one step abstracted. And that's pretty neat. On the other hand, I don't know if I want to wear those clothes. Like, I'd rather stick with the simpler pleasure of, hey, look at this. A suit is a machine that's designed to enhance my sex characteristics.
Right, right. I mean, I guess you know, the latter category that you talked about can be further divided, I'm sure, you know, infinitely. But the two things that I'm thinking of is there's one that's sort of a generic, not generic, but sort of a general exploration of form, you know, ideas about shapes and silhouettes and colors and, you know, sort of abstraction. But then there's the other thing that seems much more in line with the Comme des Garçons stuff that John Waters talks about, which is specifically institutional critique, specifically saying things like, oh, I bet you didn't think I could do this, but I can, you know, which is slightly different.
But in fashion, I think, as in any kind of design, you know, it is also about, you know, that institutional critique is not totally abstracted. So it's not like fine art where, I mean, these are things that are meant to be sold to people, even if they're not meant to be sold to people in large numbers, but they're meant to be sold to people and for those people to wear them, mm-hmm. you know, just like John Waters does. And part of that is about when you are inverting the rules or when you subverting the rules or whatever, you know, when you're putting the buttons on the inside instead of the outside. Part of what you're doing is not just saying, hey, I can do whatever I want, but hey, I figured out how to make this something, mm-hmm. you know, make this a functional, and that when I say functional, I mean, you know, literally functional as in wearable, but also aesthetically functional as in interesting to look at thing.
Yeah.
Even if that means, you know, making giant pants and tiny jackets or, you know, whatever, making something that physically can be worn and has a physically pleasing or aesthetically pleasing effect are both considerations. And part of what's so cool about the trick of subverting everything is that you're demonstrating, oh, I thought of a new solution to an old problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jesse, I think we got it, unless there's anything else you want to add about fashion and style.
No, sir. I appreciate you taking the time.
No, hey, no, thank you so much for coming on. It was a great thrill to have you here.
Sorry if I trailed off from time to time. That's the effect of the migraine pill I took an hour and a half ago.
That's the effect of my unique format too. So,
okay,
I take blame as well. So hang on one second while I read the credits. This has been Necessary and Sufficient. Thanks so much for listening. And thanks again to Jesse Thorne for joining me. Jesse, can we play sentence completion?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I asked Jesse to come on today's episode because
of his marginal internet celebrity.
Which includes
podcasting, that most marginal of internet media forms, and menswear fashion blogging, that most marginal of fashion blogging forms.
And yet,
he managed to generate a few insights despite his general cloudy mindedness, thanks to migraine medication he took not that long ago.
But not
that many.
Okay. You can subscribe to the podcast in the iTunes store or at duckandshed.net, where you'll also find the Necessary and Sufficient archives and a bunch of information, including how you can suggest a topic or a guest or send a donation. While you're there, please visit the comments section to share your thoughts on today's conversation, because I'd love to hear from you out there in the inky night. Say goodnight, Jesse.
Good night. Jesse.